Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning. This is Emily Rowell with Atlanta Legal Experts, and I'm excited to be here today. It's a special Veterans Day episode. Happy Veterans Day, everyone. And thank you so much to all those who sacrificed for our country. I have my co-host here, Ryan McPherson. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good. And you actually are a veteran as well.
That is right. I'm a former U.S. Army infantryman, 2005-2010, and proud here to be surrounded by some former military guys here today as well.
Good. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce everybody, and then we'll come back to you, and you can talk a little bit more about your experience.
Okay, certainly.
Great. So today we have Fred Berkey with the Berkey Law Firm.
Good morning.
He's an Atlanta legal expert for sure. And we have Kelly Michael Hunley with Kelly Michael Hunley, LLC.
Good morning. Catchy name, isn't it?
Yes, I like it. And we have our veteran guests, Lane Dennard with Emory Law Volunteer Clinic for Veterans. Good morning. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. And Carrie King with Jacobs & King, LLC.
Good morning.
Good morning. And last but not least, Drew Early with Shoemaker & Shoemaker.
Hi, Emily. Thanks.
Absolutely. So let's get back to Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit more about Veterans Day.
Veterans Day was originated and after Armistice Day, November 11th, 1919, the first anniversary of the end of World War I. Congress later passed a resolution in 1926 for an annual observance, and now November 11th is a national holiday. Veterans Day is not to be confused with Memorial Day, a common misunderstanding according to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Memorial Day, the fourth Monday in May, honors veterans who service members who died in service to their country or as a result of injuries occurred during battle. While Veterans Day pays tribute to all American veterans, living or dead, especially to the ones who continually serve our country honorably. So happy Veterans Day to everyone out there serving, no matter what branch of service you're in. And we look forward to celebrating this day here on Atlanta Legal Experts.
Yes, thank you. And you guys get lots of freebies, too, I saw online.
Right, restaurants, giveaways, breakfast, lunch, dinner. I don't think I have to pay for a meal anywhere today if I so choose.
That's awesome. I love that. So, okay, great. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
And thank you for helping me with the co-hosting today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank
you. I'll definitely be looking to you. So let's start with Fred Berkey. Thanks again for being here. And I'm going to just read your bio real quick and then ask some questions to you. What if you took a taxi one night to celebrate with friends and you ended up seriously injured when a car hit the taxi, then took off? And when you tried to get help to pay for injuries and loss of income, your insurance company denied your claim because no one could find the at-fault driver. This is what happened to Melissa. What if you were stopped by police on a misdemeanor and incarcerated, but while detained, you fell seriously ill and denied proper medical treatment? Would you risk death? That is what happened to James. When faced with unforeseen crisis, people should choose the best legal representation that has the know-how and commitment to take on aggressive insurance adjusters and mounting healthcare bills. Fred Berkey of the Berkey Law Firm successfully litigated the cases of Melissa and James. Since 1994, the Berkey Law Firm has obtained verdicts and settlements valued over millions of dollars for individuals and families who have been seriously harmed by the actions of dangerous drivers or harmed due to no fault of their own. The practice focuses on trucking accidents, car accidents, and accidents caused by drunk and reckless drivers, often exceeding client expectations. The Berkey Law Firm is dedicated to legal excellence and integrity while providing a voice that gives clients a fair shot at justice. Awesome.
Thanks. Thanks.
So tell me more. What is the criteria a person should look for in choosing a personal injury attorney?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I think the most important thing is to look at their experience, whether they focus solely on doing that type of work. Injury work is very specialized. There's a lot of traps for the unwary. Mm-hmm. And I think also, too, if you look at someone's commitment to the work and the craft, look at their affiliations, look at the organizations to which they belong. You can tell I'm a little nervous. I've never done a radio show before.
No, it's okay. Just a conversation.
I got to practice on putting some air through as I talk. But, you know, some of the key organizations for injury attorneys are going to be the American Association for Justice.
Okay.
The Georgia Trial Lawyers Association. What else? Southern Trial Lawyers Association, of which I'm a member of all those organizations.
Mm-hmm.
What else can I tell you?
Well, tell me, what can a person expect in the process once hiring an attorney after an auto accident?
Good question. Well, first off, I would say if you're talking with an attorney, an injury attorney in particular, you know, be comfortable in what you're seeing from the attorney when you're talking with him. If he's comfortable answering questions, even really tough questions,
okay,
I say that's a good sign. That's a sign of his confidence in knowing what he or she is doing. If you have an attorney that's not comfortable answering your questions, then that's a tip that perhaps they're not quite as confident in the work or what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the process starts with hiring the attorney, and that's really best done as soon as possible so that evidence doesn't get gone. We can get out there and use accident reconstruction experts and so forth.
Gotcha.
And then the process from our side, the attorney representing the client, is to collect information. That's a huge part of our effort.
Mm-hmm.
Getting information from all different sources, insurance, medical records, medical bills, reconstruction, determining what happened at the scene, and that's particularly important with truck cases. Mm. People don't realize, but in truck cases, there's an enormous amount of data that's collected on those tractors mm-hmm. and trailers.
Right.
Sensors, what you might think of as the black box. If you don't get in there quick, that data happens to get lost, quote unquote, if
mm-hmm.
you will.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's data from sensors and inbound and outbound communication. All those tractors you see on the highway, they have what's called inbound and outbound messaging data that's
okay.
transmitted and activated by GPS.
Hmm. Wow.
So that the big trucking companies like Heartland Express or some of the others you see on the roadway, they're communicating with their dispatch people constantly, so they know where they are. So a lot of times we can reconstruct from point A to point B and know how fast a truck was going before the collision. I had one case recently where we tracked that
wow.
data on GPS,
mm-hmm.
and from Charleston to Atlanta, he made that run in something like 5 hours to the west side during rush hour.
Oh, my goodness.
We calculated that at points along the way, he was doing over 90 miles an hour.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's good to have all that information. So that's, like you said, that's important to get straight away, like as soon as...
Quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as you possibly can.
Immediately.
So when looking for an attorney, they've said in the past on the show, like to try to, actually like you would a doctor, to interview a couple of them and then see who you would, instead of just going with one person, you know, right away, and see who you would kind of jive with, I guess would be a...
You know, that's probably not a bad idea. Sometimes I'll have folks who meet with me and say, you know, I'd like some time to talk to some other people. And I say, you know, that's probably not a bad idea. You know, find out who you're comfortable with and look
sure.
for... you know, their credentialings I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and their experience in the work. If I were to ask an attorney, if I were to choose one, I'd say, all right, how much of this work do you do? How long have you been doing it? And ask very specific questions like, what's going to happen? How long is it going to take?
Right. Like, you don't want to mm-hmm. start off with that attorney, and then all of a sudden you're talking to 20 other people that's really handling your case. So to stick with one, hopefully.
I'm not sure I followed you on the last, but...
Well, let's get back to the injuries. Tell me, what can a person do if medical bills start piling up?
That has been, in the last 6 or 7 years, a very tricky proposition now with different healthcare initiatives that are coming
sure.
on board. It used to be that I only had to worry about establishing that someone did something wrong and then, you know, proving that that wrong brought about or caused injury.
Okay.
And then what the damages were. Now I'm finding within the last 6-7 years that I've got a fourth battle to fight, and that mm-hmm. is protecting the recovery from what we call subrogation or reimbursement interests. Mm. That is in the background, health insurance companies, through different forms like ERISA, of which some of the attorneys at the table might be familiar, are looking to take that money back from an injured person who recovered it.
Wow.
So
wow.
we have to fight that fight.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, are there any specific coverages an auto owner should have to protect
yes.
them in the event of an accident?
Sorry, I interrupted you. This is a topic I'm really passionate about because I see this tragedy occurring all the time. People assume that because they've been involved in an accident, someone's going to pay for it. That is not true. If the at-fault party does not have enough insurance, that's it. There's no getting any more.
Oh,
so
wow.
typically, your average driver on the roadway has only got $25,000 liability.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a case that the lady's in Grady Hospital right now. I think she'll sign with me this afternoon, hopefully, because I think I can help her.
Yeah.
I suspect, you know, it's one of these carriers you see on TV that advertise heavily. Typically, those carriers only have limits minimum, $25,000. She's been in Grady for a week.
Oh, no.
That means approximately her bills are about $75,000, perhaps $100,000.
Right.
So that means unless she's got uninsured motorist coverage to protect her, she only has the at-fault liability to look to, which means she only gets $25,000.
Wow.
So my advice to everybody is get as absolutely much uninsured motorist coverage as you can afford, and it's not that much.
Mm-hmm. Because not only are you dealing with an injury, but now you're dealing with debt.
You're dealing with what's going to happen. I got to pay all these medical bills. I've got to pay for time I'm out of work.
Mm-hmm.
Uninsured motorist coverage would protect you. And to give you an illustration of what that cost difference might be, I helped some architects that I used to share space with review their policy.
Mm-hmm.
They had like minimum limits, you know, UM coverage 25. They boosted it to well over 100,000, and it only cost them an extra $65 a year.
Wow. Wow, that's nothing. Wow. All right, just another kind of different aspect. What is the legal environment if you are hit as a pedestrian?
Pedestrian cases are tricky. The legal environment, I'm not exactly certain what you mean. What's the landscape? What are the dynamics? I will tell you, like motorcycle cases, pedestrians are tough cases because usually they're really seriously injured when they're hit, and they're not there to defend themselves to the investigating officer when he arrives. So the first battle I got to fight with a motorcycle wreck case or a pedestrian is to quickly get out and establish the evidence and locate witnesses to portray that side of what occurred. Otherwise, the officer, knowing nothing else, is going to write up what the at-fault party is going to say. And, of course, you know, they're slanted towards what, you know, they say happened.
Right.
I got a motorcycle wreck case now with that very situation. My guy, when the officer arrived, was laid out and they thought he was dead. He woke up 4 days later after a coma in the hospital in an MRI scan.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. And he was hit by a box truck.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you really have knowledge on this and that you really take care of each person that you serve and help.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit of how our client, or tell our listeners, how they can get in touch with you.
Easy. Just I'm in Colony Square and here in Midtown. My number is 770-587-5529. It's Berkey Law Firm. I've got a webpage with the same name, Berkey Law Firm.
Okay.
And that's how they can reach me. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. You did a great job.
Yeah. Thanks. Very good.
A little nerve-wracking.
That's right.
So here we go, and we are, I'm apologize, I'm messed up here. We have Kelly Michael Hunley here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Awesome. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine.
Good.
I'm doing fine.
Good. I think he did set the bar kind of high. What do you think?
I think he did too. Hopefully I won't lower it too far.
We'll see. Okay, so Mr. Hunley, for more than 25 years, Kelly Michael Hunley has been a trusted legal advisor to businesses and executives in all manner of industry across the Metro Atlanta region and nationally. Having spent time in the boardroom and on the shop floor, Kelly understands that legal issues don't arise in a vacuum. Whether it's a lawsuit, helping a client chart a path to avoid a lawsuit, or helping a new business figure out what laws impact what it wants to do, the focus and philosophy is the same, providing practical, effective advice and solutions tailored to each client's unique circumstances. That's a lot.
Good. That is a lot.
It's a great summary.
That comes from 27 years of being in the trenches with business owners and fighting these battles and helping them kind of navigate their way through all these employment laws that, quite frankly, have changed a lot since I first started practicing law a long time ago.
Sure. Sure, so you got to keep abreast of all the laws. And
I get a report online every day of whatever developments there are across the country in state employment law and federal employment law, because if you don't stay on top of it, you quickly fall behind and then you start giving bad advice.
Sure, sure. Tell me the most common mistakes a new or small business owner makes from your perspective.
Well, you know, let me use an analogy. If your car starts to make a whining noise, you take it to the mechanic.
Sure.
If you are still in the printing industry, you regularly take equipment down and maintain it because it's your livelihood and you can't afford to have it break down. Most business owners and employers neglect to manage the most valuable asset they have, which is their employee. You know, you can have the best equipment in the world, you can have the best product to sell, but if you don't have people out there actually doing what it takes to generate the revenue, you don't have much of a business. And business owners tend to neglect how they direct and manage their employees, and that's where they stumble. Particularly small business owners and new business owners, they're, and rightly so, they are covered up with the idea of, I've got to get my product out, I've got to generate this revenue stream.
Sure.
You know, I'll hire Fred, I'll hire Carrie, and put them out there to start selling, and they're going to go sell, and that I'm going to count the money as it comes in. And then they forget about Carrie and Fred.
Mm-hmm.
And Carrie and Fred can do a lot of damage and can harm
you
your
no
business.
Idea.
I was waiting for that.
They can harm your business before you can ever get it off the ground. And so the biggest problem that business owners have is that they neglect to pay attention to what they need to do to protect themselves from the downside risks that employees present.
I think that's huge advice, especially for brand new.
Well, you know, we sit around this table this morning and everybody nods their heads like, that is great advice. Most business owners, however, I shouldn't say most, it usually takes a crisis before a business owner recognizes that.
Right.
And sometimes you catch the crisis early enough that you can avert real harm, and quite frankly, sometimes you don't. And, you know, I've found myself in both situations, and it's very troubling to be sitting there talking to a new business owner whose business is now completely at risk of falling apart because they didn't take the time on the front end, you know, the old AMCO, pay me now, pay me later.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't take time on the front end to pay attention to some things that they could have done to avoid the mess that they're in now.
Are there any signs or anything they could look out for as far as on the employee side, or is that for another interview?
You know, one of the things that I've always found interesting about relationships between employers or managers and those that they manage is when there are open lines of communication,
mm-hmm.
And you're hearing from employees, and employees are talking to you, and you're talking with them. Typically, you will know long before there's a problem that there's a potential problem.
One thing
that I tell business owners to pay attention to is not that employee that keeps knocking on their door and telling them what's going on, but they need to pay mm-hmm. attention to the person that never darkens their door,
mm-hmm.
because those are ones that you have to be careful about. Now, sometimes they're just great employees. You know, as my dad used to say, come to work, head down, plow on through, go home,
mm-hmm.
you know. But in this day and time, it's just not always the case anymore. The silent ones and the quiet ones and the reserved ones are sometimes the ones you need to worry most about.
Sure. Mm. Tell me the common misperceptions about lawyers and what y'all do.
Is there just one? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. What time is the show over?
Yeah, right.
He wrote the question.
I did write that question. You know, I think one of the biggest misperceptions, and it's one that I encounter, and I'll bet everybody else does too, is the notion that every legal matter can be handled within the hour time frame of L.A. law and law and order and and what have you, and that things always run swimmingly and quickly, and you get the result that you want within an hour. You know, and it's just not that way.
Right.
There are drags that create delays that lawyers just cannot control. And, you know, court dockets, for example, is one of them. Court dockets are overwhelming in most jurisdictions. You know, when you tell a client that when the lawsuit gets filed, it may be 18 months before they get a final resolution, you know, the blood usually just drains out of their mm-hmm. face at that point. There are some things that lawyers can do to move things along, but quite frankly, a lot of the timing is out of the lawyer's hands.
Right.
And that's the most frustrating thing that I think that my clients have to contend with is that, and it's framed by what they see on TV.
Sure.
You know, unfortunately, my wife asks me all the time, why don't you watch these legal shows or read these legal books? And it's like, no, are you kidding me? It is so far removed from reality that mm-hmm. I might as well just grab a pure fantasy book and
right.
read it.
Right.
Ryan? Okay, yeah, I'd like to ask you a few questions. Mm-hmm. A newer small business owner who's just getting started, what are some of the processes and things they should think about when coming to talk to you, particularly?
Well, they need to think about, for example, they need to think about whether their employees are going to be the ones, for example, that are at and about selling their business. In other words, are they going to be sales reps? Are they going to be counter people? Are they going to be people that are out like pharmaceutical sales reps going from door to door? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that happens that employers need to be wary about is you've entrusted all of this material and information and the secrets of your business to these individuals, and you've put them out there. They're the face of your company. You know, Carrie's out there selling you know, pharmaceuticals for you, and he has a great bedside manner, and he gets through doors that nobody else can get through because he develops all this goodwill. And then he decides one day, hey, why can't I just do this on my own? Mm-hmm. Why do I need to share whatever I'm earning with the guy that's pulling the strings on me? So they need to think about, do they have a need to limit what those individuals can do when they leave? What do they do about protecting their confidential information? Those are things that they need to think about and be mm-hmm. concerned about. And, you know, Georgia courts within the last 3 years has really made that an easier process for employers if they wake up and pay attention to it.
So the evolving legal landscape of employers, employees changes from year to year.
It changed dramatically from the legislature 3 years ago in terms of ability to put in place what we call these covenants not to compete, covenants not to solicit. So that, you know, take for example an insurance agency where someone is out there soliciting business on your behalf. You know, it was not unusual 10 years ago to try to put in place a prohibition that if you leave me, you can't come back and solicit all these businesses that you solicited for me. And you had to be very meticulous in how you drafted that, you know, 10 years ago because Georgia courts didn't like them. The legislature took a look at that about 3 years ago and decided that they didn't like that. And so they've made it easier to put those kinds of protections in place and to make them enforceable. So, you know, again, it's one of those things where you have to pay attention to what's going on so that you can help these clients when they come through the door.
And it sounds like the state has taken a responsibility to protect businesses like yourself from being taken advantage of by some of these clients out there.
It's interesting. And, you know, when the legislature was looking at this, there were some very powerful arguments on both sides of whether they should make these more enforceable or more easily to enforce or less easy to enforce, because there are pro-business reasons on both sides mm-hmm. of that. And there was quite a vigorous debate about it, not just at the legislature, but also just amongst employment lawyers like myself and others about whether this was going to be beneficial. But they made the decision to make it easier to enforce because they believe that employers need to have protections in place to preserve their information and preserve their competitive position right. relative to other businesses that are coming into the state.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, you did such a great job of summarizing again as well. I wanted to kind of change the topic a little bit and tell me more of the impact of social media on small businesses. And
well, you know, it's, again, how much time do we have?
Just about a minute left.
I'll try to sum it up this way. Social media and employees commenting on social media about their bosses, the business, what they're doing, how they're going about doing things, it creates a potential quicksand area for employers because there are things that employees can say and do with social media that you as an employer can control. And then there are lots of things that they can say and do through social media that if you try to control it or take action against an employee because of it, you may find yourself having some federal agency come knock on your door and tell you that you can't do it. And the rules about what you can and can't do in this area, as you can understand with the evolution of technology, is still evolving.
Yes.
And
sure.
Federal courts, state courts, and agencies are all over the place about what you can and can't do. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's why I take those online feeds every day about what's happening around the country, because I have clients with locations scattered across the country, and what they may be able to do in Georgia, they may not be able to do in California. In fact, they probably can't.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. We'll have to have you back. It seems like there's a lot more that we could talk about. Tell me how the listeners can get in touch with you.
Well, if they want to call me, they can just call me at my office number, which is 770-680-4391. They can also go to my website, kind of like Fred. It's a very catchy website, kellyhunleylaw.com.
Oh, yeah.
And that has all the contact information for people to be able to find me.
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Okay, we have Lane Dennard. Thank you for being so patient.
and glad to be here.
Yes, good. And he's with the Emory Law Volunteer Clinic for Veterans. He is a veteran, was born in Macon, Georgia, and graduated from Mercer University in Macon with an AB degree in 1966. He served in the Army as captain and company commander in Vietnam. His decorations include a Silver Star, Air Medal, Army Commendation Medal, Combat Infantry Badge, and Purple Heart with Oak Leaf Cluster. After his military service, Mr. Dennard attended the University of Georgia School of Law, where he received the JD degree in 1973. Prior to his retirement in 2003, Mr. Dennard represented employers in the field of labor and employment law for over 30 years, litigating the full range of cases in state and federal courts. Since his retirement, Mr. Dennard's legal practice has focused on veterans advocacy and the pro bono representation of veterans in cases before the VA. In 2011, Mr. Dennard received the Georgia Bar's Marshall Tuttle Award as the top lawyer in the state providing pro bono service to veterans. He has played a role in the startup and operation of the Emory Law Volunteer Clinic for Veterans and currently serves as its co-director with Professor Charles Shanner. Awesome. Thank you so much for your service. I've got some questions. Tell me a little bit more about where you served.
I served in 1969 with the 1st Air Cav as a infantry captain in combat in Vietnam, and came back and went to law school after I got out of the service.
And tell me, how did you become involved in veterans pro bono work?
Well, I'm a veteran, so I've always been interested in the veterans work, but
sure.
About 4 or 5 years ago, I decided to start helping some veterans with the disability cases. But I didn't have any clients. So my company in Vietnam had actually gotten together with a network and kept up with each other with a website and this type of thing. And so I wrote an email to the individual who headed this up and said that I would represent pro bono anybody who served in my company in Vietnam in 1969. And I got 5 cases. You could guess what the cases are, probably. 4 of the cases were PTSD cases.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them were hearing loss cases also. Those are sort of the afflictions of the old soldier.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's how I got started, and then I received referrals from the bar from there.
Okay. And tell me about your involvement with the Emory Law Volunteer for Veterans.
Well, after I had done this for several years, and I, of course, was familiar with he's a friend, Charlie Shaner, a professor at Emory, the Georgia Bar, and actually Kerry King and Drew Early, who are here today, participated in that fully, decided that there was a need for a veterans legal clinic in the law schools in Georgia. And the law school that stepped forward first with Emory. And Professor Shaner contacted me and asked me if I would help start up and operate that clinic.
Okay.
Very nice. Yes, sir. Good morning. I'll ask you a few questions myself. You mentioned you helping some of your former soldiers in your company. Can you tell us what unit you served with?
I served with the 1st of the 7th, 1st Air Cav.
And you were the company?
Custer's unit, for some reason. They claimed that as a claim to fame.
Yeah, and they put an infantryman in a cav unit, too. That's right.
Huh? Gary Owens' unit.
Good. And so today you've helped some of your fellow veterans. How do you find these veterans today? How do you get your word out about your services?
Well, the clinic, somehow I'm on everybody's free lawyer list, so I get plenty of cases. Cases aren't a problem. But we have at the clinic a website, and we have a brochure that we're using. The bar has been very helpful in putting us on the programs for the bar. So each just this past week, I finished up reporting to both the Veterans Law Section of the Bar and the Military Legal Assistance Committee Program. The Military Legal Assistance Program also has referred cases, and we have some. So start off with, that was the main source of cases. Now we're getting cases on our own because of our own publicity.
And you do what type of cases for veterans?
We first recognized that there are a lot of veterans in Georgia, over 770,000 veterans in Georgia, over 200,000 veterans in the metro Atlanta area.
Yes, sir.
And many of those veterans are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with service-connected injuries and illnesses, mental conditions like PTSD and traumatic brain injury. And there's a large number of those people who can't afford to hire lawyers. So our objective at the clinic was to represent these veterans who couldn't afford to hire lawyers in the legal issues that they face, but we mainly focus on service-connected disabilities.
That's great, and you're doing great work on there. How many cases have you had up to this date?
Well, when we opened our doors, of course, we had none. So we were sort of like me starting out. But since February of last year, we've almost been operating 2 years. We've had 87 cases. We've had 67 student volunteers. And we've had 72 lawyers volunteer to participate with these
cases.
That's
great.
Out of those 72, 49 have actually participated in a case. So we've had a significant number of cases. When I first started doing it, after 2 or 3 weeks, after a month or two, everybody said, well, how many cases have you won? Gracious, it takes the VA 5 years to decide a case. So we're not there yet. But at this point in time, we have had some successful dispositions. We've had 16 successful disposition in cases.
Excellent.
And out of those, actually, you could calculate an economic value to maybe 8 of them. Mm-hmm. And the economic value we've calculated is over $1,900,000.
Outstanding.
Wow. Yeah. Tell me one of your significant cases that you like.
Okay, I'll tell you about one with the clinic. Of course, I had some significant cases before the clinic started, but the one we had at the clinic is we represented the wife of an Iraqi war vet who had died at the VA hospital. He died of a condition that was not service-connected, but he left his widow and four minor children.
Mm-hmm.
So the VA had denied that case, denied the claim that we filed for, or that she had filed for, a service-connected condition. We argued that another condition that was service-connected significantly contributed to the death. And we ended up winning the case in less than
fantastic.
A year.
That's great.
Which gives her a pension of about $2,600 a month. And the main thing is the four kids get the GI Bill.
That's
so they're
great.
Educated.
Right.
And they get
fantastic
health care benefits. So that's one of the most significant
cases. Yeah, something you can be very proud of, too. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's wonderful. Now, tell me, people that are looking for you, you mentioned you have a website.
I don't know. I can't give it to you, but I think you can Google in. Actually, it's under the Emory Law School. Emory Law School clinics, and then you pull up the website for the clinic.
Okay, and then I also have you at Law Veterans Clinic at emory.edu.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and a phone number?
706-572. Wait a minute, I'm giving you my home phone.
Well, we can call you there, too, if you want.
Scratch all that. 404-572-2507.
Great. Well, yes. We so appreciate you being here today, taking the time, and then also all of your time, your life's time, to serve us and serve the country. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Yes. Now we've got Carrie King.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hanging in there?
Hanging in there.
And he is an Atlanta native who graduated from Georgia State University in 63 with a Bachelor of Arts degree and received a law degree from John Marshall Law School in 83. As an attorney, he currently practices as the senior attorney in the firm of Jacobs & King, LLC, along with his son Scott, Greg Jacobs, and four other attorneys. In 2013, January of 2013, he was awarded the Marshall Tuttle Award as well as the Outstanding Lawyer of 2013 by the Military and Veterans Affairs Section of the State Bar of Georgia, and received a Certificate of Appreciation from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in Washington, D.C. After graduating from college, he entered the United States Army and was commissioned through the ROTC program. He served on active duty as regular Army officer until 1970. He retired from Army Reserve, Army National Guard in 87 after 24 years total service. In Vietnam, he served in the infantry with 2nd Battalion, 28th Infantry, 2nd Brigade of the 1st Infantry Division, supervising and conducting search and SEAL operations, and commanded both C Battery, 1st Battalion, 7th Artillery, and HHB, 1st Infantry Division Artillery. And you have a lot of decorations for your service. Can you tell me a little bit about those, especially the five bronze stars?
I can't remember them. I don't particularly want to talk about the specific decorations,
sure.
But all of us who served, I commanded both infantry, an infantry unit and an artillery unit in combat, so the decorations are related to those. I was wounded a couple times.
And you've got some...
Got some
medals
fruit
on
salad on.
Chest.
Yeah, I have. The only reason I'm wearing it today is that for Veterans Day, I have several functions to attend. So
sure, sure.
Some of those.
We'll get you out of here quickly. Okay. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Tell me the difficulty of military personnel transitioning back into civilian life.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, particularly right now, based on the fact that you've got. First of all, you've got a reduction in force going on in all the branches of service. The Army, for example, I've been told, is going to reduce about 120,000 men,
Sorry.
Which will bring them down to a standing army of about somewhere around 200 and about 420 total, of which 250,000 are going to be combat troops. So the bulk of those are going to be support troops that are remaining. So all those people who were career people are going to be looking around for employment. And the difficulty is the Army is a particular culture that you live in, and there's certain ways you function and the way you live on a day-to-day basis. Coming back to civilian life is a rude shock. You come back and you may have gone from being a major, a lieutenant colonel, or a sergeant major and being treated with great respect and deference to being just another guy on the street. So they need, I believe, both transitional help through the military itself, and there's a program afoot right now to do that within 120 days of the day they get out. But they also, employers need to recognize the quality of these people coming out, recognize that these are people who know how to abide by rules. These are people who know how to accomplish a mission, if you will, whether that mission be civilian or military, and take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you expand on that a little more? Tell me, what are some of the assets a military person may bring to the civilian world in the employment force?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, they know how to both give and take orders, and with specificity. They know how to ask what it is they need to accomplish the mission, and then they know how to go and do the mission. Secondly, they are disciplined in that they are used to following certain protocols and procedures. So to use some of the examples that Kelly was referring to, if you bring in somebody and you explain to him these are the circumstances and you're going to have some restrictions if you leave by employment, they'll not only understand it, they'll honor it because they're used to having certain restrictions in their own military occupation.
Sure.
They're also, nowadays, since the military is all volunteer, they're also very bright people. They, I read somewhere and was told this as well when I went to Fort Riley about a month ago, that out of the high school graduates today, only 25% would be accepted into the military if they volunteered. So
wow.
The cut's pretty high.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, you've got all people coming out of the military now from all different backgrounds, educational as well as economic backgrounds. So I believe that there is a lot for them to offer the civilian workforce these days. But are there some of the issues that they're dealing with? How does that kind of play into that decision by employers?
The issues you're talking about,
the veterans, you know, sometimes have, is that can be a negative on a resume, I guess.
I don't think so. I mean, as a matter of fact, you know, I, for example, have had some VA disability issues, some with my hearing, as Lane correctly stated. Most soldiers have some kind of hearing issue, but that's easy to overcome. And again, we were trained to sort of work through your problems. Mm-hmm. Deal with them, get out there and handle it. And I think the greatest bulk of veterans do it and do it very well. They merge back into civilian life and are great contributors.
I agree. And more about the work you're doing for veterans, and tell us about that.
Well, first, let me just brief commercial. I'm still in private practice as well.
Okay,
sure.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm a civil and criminal litigator, which means I'm a trial lawyer. That's what I do. I might be handling family law is the biggest emphasis of my practice. But I might be doing family law today. I did years of construction litigation. So I've tried probably 400 to 500 cases and
wow.
At least 100 and plus are jury trials. So I have a lot of experience in that area. In 1998, I was approached by a guy named Mac McClendon, who was a World War II veteran who had been shot down over Germany and was a prisoner of war. And Mac told me and another Vietnam vet named Greg Studdard that he wanted to start a pro bono clinic at the VA Medical Center on Claremont Road, mm-hmm. and he needed some volunteer lawyers. So we didn't have any formal memorandum of understanding, we didn't have any formal agreement with the VA, but they gave us a little space, and through voluntary services encouraged us to do that, and that's how we started the clinic. And at this point, my estimates are we've seen something over 8,500 vets since 1998.
That's great.
Helped them
wow.
with legal issues. Probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 12,000 to 15,000 legal hours. And in the last 2 years, we have opened 3 additional clinics, pro bono clinics, one at Fort McPherson, mm-hmm. One in Carrollton, Georgia, mm-hmm. And one in Augusta, Georgia. And most recently, in addition to Lane's Emory Law School Clinic, as a matter of fact, on today's Fulton Daily Report on the front page, we are today opening at the Georgia State Law School through the auspices of the ROTC department. We are opening our second law school clinic.
Excellent.
And so we're very proud of that.
Absolutely, as it should be. And do you help the veterans on all types of cases, or is there anything particularly that you guys work on?
We, through the VA clinics, and I'm going to distinguish the 4 VA clinics versus the law school clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Through the VA clinics, we do everything but VA claims.
Okay.
That's for those type cases, we would refer them to Lane Dennard's program, or we would refer them to a private attorney such as Drew Early, for
yes,
example,
sir.
On VA benefits cases, because our view is we are sort of provided to the veteran through the VA. So the VA is not a client, but it's almost a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. So we could handle criminal matters for them. We could handle family law matters. We could handle debtor-creditor issues, landlord-tenant issues, just about anything that everybody walking around deals with. Now, we generally don't go to court with them, but we get them focused on an issue, and we put them in the right direction. And on many occasions, we do take them to court.
Excellent.
And take them all the way through.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'm loving the just from interviewing the veterans here today that, you know, they serve the country and then they come back and they continue to serve.
Yeah, that's right.
which has kind of been the theme so far, which is really awesome. Can you, I wanted to read the entire bio because it was very impressive, but you can look on AtlantaLegalExperts.com to find all of it, and then also links to all your websites, or all to all the websites of all the guests today. Can you tell our listeners how they get in touch with you?
Sure. They have to look at my business card to get the website, so excuse me. The website is Jacobs, J-A-C-O-B-S, King, .com, mm-hmm. and they can reach me. The main number is 404-920-4490, or they can talk to my paralegal, Angie, at 404-920-4489. And she does all my scheduling and knows where I am at every moment.
Okay. So. She's your right-hand gal.
Absolutely.
Thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Drew Early with Shoemaker & Shoemaker. Very patient man.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let me tell you, Drew is an elder law attorney practicing in the greater Atlanta area. He is experienced in probate and estate matters, adult guardianships and conservatorships, and trust work. His elder law work led him into adult disability matters. That, coupled with his career military experience, serves him well in assisting veterans and their families in matters before the VA. He is published and a frequent CLE presenter on elder law and VA issues. He is the immediate past chair of the military and veterans section of the GA State Bar, and also serves on the executive committee of the Georgia State Bar's Military and Legal Assistance Program. I'm used to all these, you know, acronyms. He is a registered mediator and serves on the DeKalb County Probate Court's court-appointed list as guardian ad litem. Mm-hmm. He is admitted to a variety of courts and further serves as an adjunct professor at Emory University School of Law. Lots of education that I can list on and on. Mm-hmm. And again, go to AtlantaLegalExperts.com for the remainder of his bio. And tell me, describe the Georgia State Bar's programs to enhance legal services to veterans and their families.
Thanks, Emily. Mm-hmm. As a result of Afghanistan, one of the former presidents of the State Bar went to Afghanistan through a representative, and they asked at the time the Georgia National Guard that was in present in Afghanistan, what can we, the Georgia State Bar, do to assist you? And the number one thing that they heard back was, I need help with my soldiers who have legal problems back home. They're worried about the legal problems, so they can't focus on what we've got to do here and today in Afghanistan.
Wow.
So with that as the kernel of an idea, the Georgia State Bar said, we need to do something to help. So they initiated the Military Legal Assistance Program, and the intent is to link Georgia lawyers who are willing with military members and their family members throughout the state, regardless of what the issue is. But we can find people that are geographically co-located, mm-hmm. and then perhaps on a pro bono, or it may be on a low bono basis, link them together to help with the legal issue. So it's really about the expansion of legal services to a very deserving community within the state.
Fantastic. So it helps the soldiers that are out of the country serve and concentrate on what they're doing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tell me, how did you get involved in this work yourself?
Probably like Carrie did, as well as Lane. We're retired, but we still serve.
Sure.
And that's the idea. Mm-hmm. And for me in particular, the second career of law was very appealing. But at the same time, I still had my connections with my compatriots. And they would come back and ask questions. And I said, you know, I can help in this regard. I can help them in a different manner. And that's really how it started.
Okay. Tell me, why does it seem so difficult for the veterans to deal with the VA?
Well, that's a loaded question there. But
yes, like again, Kelly says, how much time do we have?
That's right.
A lot of people don't know. The VA is the second largest cabinet agency in the U.S. government. It is a behemoth. Mm-hmm. Because it is so large, the bureaucracy associated with it is massive. And the individual typical serving soldier, sailor, airman, or marine can't confront the size of that organization. And we've had a bad economy. So a lot of people look to the VA here recently to assist for disability benefits simply because they had no other money coming in.
Right.
So we've got the point we're at now where, oh, any given day, give or take, 350 to 500,000 claims pending before the VA. Jeez. And an additional 277,000 appeals. So the average veteran today who is appealing an issue with the VA probably is looking at 3.5 to 4 years.
Right.
Meanwhile, those disability benefits aren't coming in. Mm-hmm. So they need help. And that's where I come in, try to help get them what they need and move it through. But it's a huge bureaucracy, a huge backlog. And because it's a bureaucracy, it's cumbersome. It doesn't work well. So that's right. What I do is I try to help them navigate through the system and get things going.
Do you feel that every veteran who is making a claim needs attorney advice, or can you do it on your own?
No, I don't, Ryan. I think that people can do it on their own for the simple, straightforward matters, particularly if they had a disability incurred in service and they're being discharged from service and it's fully documented. Mm-hmm. And then also here in Georgia, we've got the Georgia Department of Veterans Service, a state agency that is very helpful down at the county level to be that interface at the local level for a veteran or a family member making a claim with the VA. And on the simple, more routine matters, I think they do a great job.
So that's good. Has there been one particular case that you really want to talk about or share with our listeners?
Well, my favorite case involves a widow of an Atlanta Police Department serving officer who died of a service-connected injury, but the VA said he didn't. So we've got a widow out there with two small children. We were able to appeal the case and say no, just like Lane did with his. We think that that his death was actually incurred by a service-connected disability, and we prevailed. So she was really worried about economics. So to get that stipend coming in of $2,000 a month, it just helps her rest and have peace of mind. And she had about a $250,000 accrued benefit flowing to her as well.
Back pay. Nice.
Back pay, so we were able to take care of the house. And, you know, really deserving lady, really great situation. So, personally, it was really rewarding to me to do that. It was all done pro bono, but, you know, you get paid another way, too.
Oh, that sounds great, yeah.
You could sleep at night.
Yeah.
I mean, I know if I did that kind of work, I would be sleeping like
You're doing a very good service to help the veterans, and then particularly those who are really in need, maybe a widow of a veteran like that. So that's a good good case there.
So tell me your own service, a little bit more about that.
Well, I took a 20-year career path in the Army following graduation from West Point. And my last duty assignment, very fortunately, I was assigned to 3rd Army, which was based here in Atlanta at Fort McPherson. And at the end of 20 years, my wife looked at me and said, "We want to stay in Georgia." And being the good husband that I am, I said, "Yes, dear. Of course, dear. Certainly, dear. Whatever you say, dear."
Well, thank you. Well, we really thank you for your service. And I also have to thank John Camp, because he's the one that referred. And he was a guest a couple of weeks ago. So I'd like to
thank you, John.
Give a shout out and say thank you. And we have just a couple minutes left if anybody has any questions for any of the
I wanted to mention, if I may.
Sure, please. This is
I believe Kelly was talking about social media or I'm not sure Fred might have been talking about it. In family law, what we've found in regard to social media is that frequently the things that lead to a divorce or point to why the divorce is happening is on social media or on their mobile phone. I would caution people as to what you put in your social media and what you say in your social media. I would also caution them to be careful about texting things back and forth because they become evidence.
Yeah, once it's out there,
it
never goes
particularly
away.
In family law, which is an area in itself where it's generally, excuse me, he said, she said.
Right.
Social media information often turns that into evidence.
Yeah, get you in trouble.
And I apologize, I did not ask Drew how our listeners can get in touch with you.
Well, you can get in touch with the State Bar's Military Legal Assistance Program by calling Norman Zoller at the State Bar at 404-527-8765. In terms of my practice with Shoemaker & Shoemaker, go to the website at shoemakerlaw.com, and we are at 770-939-1939.
Thank you so much. Okay. Well, I think that was a great show. What do you think?
I did enjoy all the information that was shared here today by our distinguished guests. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. Happy Veterans Day to each and every one of you.
Yes.
And may you continue to serve our community in the great fashion that you already are.
Thank you.